listeners, and welcome to a very, very special of Sex Talk. Tonight, we continue our unwavering public affairs mandate by bringing you the world's foremost expert on gay men and effeminate behavior. I refer, of course, to Tim Bergling, author, ex-Marine Corps sergeant? Corporal? Well,
guy?
He'll lay down his rank when we get one of
and
raconteur,
and world expert and author of the book, Sissy Phobia, Gay Men and Effeminate Behavior. Tim Bergling, I hope you're on the phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm right here.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic.
Great. We can hear you even.
But, and it's former Marine Corps sergeant.
Oh, wow. You had it right first time, DJ Corey.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
Excellent. Before we get started, let me ask the producers if we can take phone calls in addition to Tim. So if you want to call in, feel free to call in at 621-9728, area code 412, or on the Carnegie Mellon campus, extension 8 WRCT. So, and just so you know, Tim, the people you're talking to, I'm Lance.
DJ Corey.
And I'm Dr. Sexopolis.
Hello, Lance. Hello, Corey. And hello, Doc.
Thank you.
I think that any show about your book should start by promoting your book. I mean, we just get out there. I want you people who have the internet at home, go to Amazon.com or your other, I don't know, Barnes & Noble.
Or Sissyphobia.com.
Sissyphobia. Oh, you have your own website as well.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
And, it's the 21st century.
And the most important question is, who's this hot guy on the cover of your book? I mean,
people keep asking. They say, is that you? And my picture's on the back.
No, you're the hot guy on the back cover of the book.
I'm on the back of the book. No, that's not me. That's just, that's your typical publisher marketing ploy.
This is sort of de rigueur for, the small gay publishing
houses. Put a hot boy on the cover and hope that people will stop and go, oh, who's that? And then pick it up.
And then they're like, and then they open it and they're like, oh, my God, there's all these words in here. And this is
but we also have pictures.
You
my illustrator, Joe Phillips,
do.
He's a very popular illustrator who has several calendars out. Anybody interested can go to joephillips.com.
Check out
his calendar and his artwork. He's very, very gifted, and I was very fortunate that as I wrote each chapter, I would send him the chapter, and he would pick a scene out of there and illustrate it. So he gave me some great drawings to go
excellent,
along with my
excellent.
Work.
You first.
I was going to say, much praise we can heap on the artwork, right? That's only, that's only a small part of the book.
Go ahead. I was going to say
we should
start up by introducing what is this book and what is it about. I guess that's we should introduce the thesis of the book.
Well, the book asks two questions. First, where does effeminate behavior come from in gay men? Why do some men behave in an effeminate way? Less than manly way, quote unquote, and why is it some men don't? Why are some men pretty much undetectable? And the other question, and probably the more important question, what is it about effeminate behavior that gets society's panties all up in a bunch? Or to turn that question around, what is it about society that has such a problem with men who behave in an effeminate manner? So those are basically what the book is about and all the various permutations of those two phenomena.
And all of America is waiting for your one-sentence answer to each one of those questions.
Okay, well, the one-sentence question is, or one-sentence answer is, depends on who you talk to, because there's lots of theories. The book doesn't purport to have answers to the extent of, I'm going to tell you now where effeminate behavior comes from.
No, you seem to
where effeminate behavior comes from frequently depends on what you believe, where you believe the whole manifestation of male same-sex orientation comes from, because the answer to one depends on the answer to the other.
I was going to say, reading the book, you seem to go out of your way to present diverse points of view, lots of anecdotes, lots of contrasting anecdotes, too. So you're definitely not trying to provide, despite Lance's humorous comment, you're not trying to provide simple little pat answers to these complex questions.
Well, there are sometimes simple answers to complex questions, but this is not one of those times.
Let me ask a question about portrayals of gays in the media. So to give, for example, the listeners to our show who, for example, probably never met an effeminate gay man, what sort of contemporary media, media characters in sitcoms, movies, whatever, do you think sort of exemplify the behavior you're trying to get at?
Well, there are a couple of examples. If you want to look at somebody who gives a really realistic portrayal of a quote-unquote effeminate gay man, though if you talk to the actor, he goes, oh, really, is he? Because he doesn't really try to go for that. But then, you know, when I talked to him, I actually interviewed him. His name is Bill, actor's name is Bill Bruckdrup, and he portrays the receptionist on NYPD Blue, the receptionist John Irvin, whose effeminate behavior is cast in even sharper relief because of the really tough, gritty detectives he works for, your Sipowitz and such, if you ever watch NYPD Blue on ABC.
Yeah, we do. I think they're one of the sponsors of the show. I actually was going to say, I thought you were going to say Charles Nelson Reilly or Paul Lynn, but I guess
those are good examples of what I call flamboyant behavior, which is, you know, effeminate behavior dressed up in a boa. It's a much different phenomenon. It's the over-the-top, really in-your-face, you know, flamboyant thing, like kind of like Jack on Will and Grace.
I was just going to say, yeah,
the more over-the-top. He's a little more of a cartoon.
Right. See, yeah. it continues to amaze me that America, which was almost completely in the closet, you know, in the 60s, could somehow embrace Paul Lynn to its bosom without really
And Liberace, the classic example, right? flamey, gay man.
That's when it was an in-joke. That's when, because show business has always been gay.
True, maybe it was an in-joke, but
has always been really over the top gay, and so they're frequently had these characters that have been in movies. Usually the next door neighbor. He wasn't ever portrayed as gay per se, but there was always something that was really, you know, over the top and flamboyant. And the gay people watching got the joke, and the people inside the industry got the joke. But middle America just thought, oh, what a funny guy.
I mean, you make an interesting historical comment in your book, in your favor, you don't say it's absolute truth, and it's only a theory. But the idea that, like, effeminate behavior being despised as a sign of homosexuality started with Oscar Wilde.
Yes, absolutely.
In the 19th century.
And believe me, that's not my theory. There's a lot of people who share that. It's a theory because, you know, it's really hard to point to any one phenomena and say this led to that.
Right.
That doesn't usually happen unless you're talking about the big broad stroke of historical events.
Right. My point was going to be, it wasn't even as sudden as that. It wasn't even like, oh, Oscar Wilde turned the page on effeminate behavior in men from like, oh, this is just something wacky guys do, to this is something homosexuals do. Because, you know, as Lance was saying, it persisted even into the 50s and 60s here in America, where women would think, oh, that wonderful Liberace, why isn't he married?
And my mother such a catch. Never got the clue that the guy was gay.
I bet people just thought he played the field.
Well, he might have been one of the last people who actually could have gotten away with it being over the top. And show busy and, you know, flamboyant, and people didn't think he was gay, because I think his popularity lasted into the late 60s, and then, of course, you had the great, you know, gay liberation movement, and that's when everybody began to realize, oh, those guys are probably gay.
But before we get to that, I'd like to say that I emceed a wedding in Liberace's house. And that was really when I first realized that he was, in fact, gay and not simply eccentric.
Are you joking with me?
No.
You met Liberace?
No, Liberace was long dead.
Okay.
But his house gets rented out for weddings and parties and stuff.
I was going to say, I didn't think I was talking to anybody quite that old.
You emceed a wedding in
Liberace's
house.
Well, yeah, radio hides a multitude of sins.
All right.
As DJ Corey is all too fond of pointing out. But to get into the gay liberation, sort of the gay liberation movement, one of the things that interests me that I've never really known a lot about were the Stonewall riots.
Yes.
And I was wondering, one, if you could talk about them, and then if maybe DJ Corey, as a gay liberation guerrilla himself, could chime in.
Well, there are a lot of people that, of course, trace the beginning of the modern gay rights movement to Stonewall. And what Stonewall is, people hear that, and they don't always know what it means. And a lot of younger gay guys hear before Stonewall or after Stonewall. And if they've seen the excellent documentaries on PBS, they know what it's all about. But simply, in broad strokes, simply what it is that it was June 28th in 1969, and it was a typical practice in New York City in those days to go and, you know, homosexuality was illegal, and definitely homosexual acts were illegal. You couldn't arrest somebody simply for being gay, but if you caught them doing anything, you could certainly arrest them, and it was typical for the New York City Police Department, I guess when they got bored, would go out and roust a gay bar, a fag bar, as they were frequently called. And if they caught anybody doing anything, they would, you know, shut the place down and haul the people off. And on this particular night, though, they picked a bar called the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village. And Judy Garland had just died. And I don't know if you realize the iconic status that Judy Garland had.
Oh, yeah.
And to some degree still has in the gay community, and there's all sorts of theories about why that is.
Can you confirm that, DJ Corey?
Let's take that as a given that she was somewhat of an icon at the time. And the drag queens and drunks and people on the fringes of society who were sitting there in the bar when the police came in. On this particular night, they weren't having it. And they started throwing things at the cops, and they basically forced them back out on the street. And at one point, I believe, it actually turned around. The cops were inside the bar, and everybody was outside keeping them in. And it just turned into this big riot, and the word spread through the neighborhood, and people turned out, and it actually lasted for several nights. Eventually, the police and the city leaders called on what passed for the gay rights movement in those days, because there wasn't much, and asked them to cool things down, and they said they would in exchange for some concessions from the city police department. And the gay rights movement was born because somebody had faced down authority, who was authority figures who were persecuting people who were gay, and people heard about it literally all around the world, and they said, wow, we can stand up for ourselves. So it's kind of like, you know, I call it the Lexington and Concord of the modern gay rights movement. I think I was talking to you earlier. I referred to it as the vodka shot heard around the world. And that's basically what it was. It sounds so silly sometimes when you recount it, but it's, you know, there was such a revolutionary fervor in the air anyway in the late 60s. Of course, the, you know, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement. So it was probably only a matter of time. These things simply require a catalyst, and that was the catalyst.
Yeah, I think I saw a movie, something like that. I mean, this is half kidding and half serious, but the half kidding part is I think I saw a movie where a bunch of cops get stuck in a gay bar and have a couple of drinks, and all of a sudden, you know, there's nightsticks everywhere. but actually, half seriously, on the point of your book, you know, I sort of wonder, what's your sort of insight, you think, into the psychology of the kind of police officer who, you know, might get a kick out of arresting gay people? I mean, do you think there's some kind of...
repressed homophobia or repressed self-loathing or something? Of course, it's always possible. I mean, some people are simply bullies and like to pick on anybody who they presume to be weaker.
Right.
And other people have a definite loathing for people who are gay, and I touch on this in the book in several chapters. There's definitely people who have certain orientations themselves that they're trying to keep deeply buried, and you can't, you know, beat yourself up, so you find somebody who has that orientation and you beat them up.
Right, and you talk about this. I think there was, I can't remember the scientist, Adams, this study who did.
The late Dr. Henry Adams.
Right, the electric shock experiment.
Yeah, if you'd like me to tell you, talk about it. I mean, that's one of the ways he measured this. We've always had the theory in the gay community that people who dislike or outright, you know, hate gay people and sometimes commit violence against them, that they're probably gay themselves. You know, that's a typical, you know, as I said, it's a typical manifestation. You hate in others what you hate in yourself. But his idea was to see if you could somehow measure that. And so what he did was he gathered a lot of subjects together in a University of Georgia campus, told them they were going to be conducting a study into human sexuality in college-age males. And what they did was they gave them tests. And the tests had several, like, questions that would indicate to the reviewer how homophobic the subject was. All the homophobic guys were basically then, their records were flagged, and they took them into rooms and told them they were going to be looking at different kinds of pornography. And they attached around their sex organs.
You can say penis.
Can I say penis? I wasn't sure because I got the lecture from the guy before about what I could say and what I couldn't say.
Imagine where your elderly maiden aunts.
How can I talk about my book? But Dr. Henry Adams used to love to call it the Peter meter. And what it does is it measures basically arousal. And the subjects watched these different films. They watched men having sex with men, women having sex with women, and men and women having sex. And that information, pardon the expression, was hardwired into a computer. And, you know, they always say, you know, the penis has no memory, and it apparently has, you know, no ability to lie either, because it clearly indicated that something like 80% of the guys who scored as homophobic also got aroused watching men having sex with men.
Which was far greater than the baseline rate of the non-homophobic men.
Absolutely.
See, now this is interesting because I've always heard that conventional wisdom thrown around,
right.
But I always sort of suspected it was an urban legend, and to see the real science backing it up is pretty intriguing.
Yes, it is. It was extremely intriguing. Actually, it was funny, sadly funny. Dr. Adams told me that what surprised him most about the test wasn't that the homophobic men were aroused, but was that he was able to find so many homophobic men on a college campus. You would assume, he said, you know, a certain amount of education a certain amount of affluence. Generally, those are good markers for people not being homophobic. You usually find homophobia among uneducated people who have never met anybody who was gay. So he was surprised he could find that many homophobic people to do a study with.
So, I'm sorry. Actually, the test I was trying to refer to, I guess I got the name wrong, which was the one about the electric shocks.
Oh, the electric shock.
You know,
oh,
that was a follow-up to that.
Yeah, well, that was the second half of the test. That was the later study. The first test actually was very useful because it set up the logic for the second story.
Right, and the second test was more about effeminate behavior.
The second was more problematic because that was the one about violence. And it was a complex test, but and I'll see if I can find a way to shorthand it, because I tried to shorthand it in the book because it was a very tough study to try to work the jargon through. But what they did was this. They basically set up a ruse, and they told these subjects that they were going to be doing a test of reaction time.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were first, they were then going to shock their opponent if they won whatever the reaction time test was. I guess it was like a game show thing where, you know, you hit something before the other guy. And if they won, they administered a shock from very mild to very severe. And in all cases, they were actually facing somebody who they were told that they would be facing different opponents, straight opponents and gay opponents, whatever. They were able to view these videotapes of their supposed opponent. And they actually had no opponent at all. Everything just went into another room where there was like an actor from the university drama department who behaved with a really effeminate mannerism. So they always thought, the homophobic guys always thought that there was a really gay guy on the other side. And when they thought there was a really gay guy on the other side, they shocked him very severely. The non-homophobic guys actually, if anything, took it easy on the supposed gay guy, and they shocked their straight opponent much more.
So, yeah, aside from the effeminacy, this is a very similar setup to the Milgram shock experiments, actually.
Right.
So my question is, it was couched as a test of reaction time, but were people able to control how severe the shocks were?
Yes, it was. They could choose a mild shock or they could choose a severe shock.
Okay. Yeah, I found that a mildly suspicious part of the test because it doesn't seem to make any sense in the context of the cover story. But that's either here nor there.
Just to remind our listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Tim Bergling, author of the book Sissyphobia, Gay Men and Effeminate Behavior. You can buy his book on any...
You can get it on Amazon.com. You can get it on Barnes & Noble. And you can also go on Sissyphobia.com and order it from there.
So I have a couple more questions about, to go back to the Stonewall riots, about the current state of law enforcement with regards to homosexual activity, right? So... gay bars never get busted anymore. Is that true?
No, that's not true.
No, there's just
they get busted all the time, but not for just simply being gay bars.
What do they get busted for?
Drug use.
Yeah, well, there's
underage patrons. If there's nude dancing inside, sometimes there's, you know, a little hanky panky going on.
there's a gay bar in a suburb outside of Pittsburgh where we were broadcasting from that routinely got busted all the time by the cops in that county. It was a very, very conservative.
They may in fact be getting busted. The main reason may be that they're gay bars, but there has to be a subterfuge.
Right, I think these are all
they can't
like,
simply bust them for being gay. I mean, they can claim there's underage drinking. They can claim that there's.
I think there are always claims of license violations, right?
They can claim that there's public sex going on, which is still illegal in a lot of places. And they can claim all these things, but usually it's simply the fact that it's a gay bar is what draws the attention to it. I mean, of course, it's not as bad. There was a gay bar in Frederick, Maryland, a town I like to call Fredneck, that had a very nice little gay bar, which at one point was a straight bar, and then the new owners, it was called Talons, and they started getting picketed by the Klan.
Wow.
And were, in fact, knocked out of business because nobody wanted to walk through a ring of guys in sheets and paramilitary uniforms.
Now, Do you think there's a feeling in the gay community that it's the effeminate, it's the flamboyant men who, quote, bring this down on the bars? I mean, I'm not trying
not
to at all place blame
not just
on.
Not bring that down on the bars, but there's a feeling among a lot of guys who fancy themselves as, and again, I hate this term, but it's a term that you have to use because it establishes their mindset, straight acting, straight looking.
Right.
The straight acting, straight looking gay guys do, in fact, to a very large degree, think that it's the effeminate guys that hold them back. That hold the gay rights movement back, and that hold gay people back from ever having, you know, true equality.
Well, DJ Carr, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, I actually find that whole thing very interesting because I've you know, I don't want to delve too much into my own psychological makeup, but I have similar feelings like that myself. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm the straightest person in this room. For example, my co-hosts are very fey. But you know, I do, you know, like if I'm in the locker room talking with one of my gay friends and he fems it up, I do get a little twinge, and then I'm like, you know, I feel terribly guilty about it because I'm like, you know, am I not part of the problem if I'm not completely free of this kind of internalized homophobia? And so, you know, when I was reading your book, I got a little twinge because I saw my own psychology all too clearly.
Yeah, that's been one of the comments I've been getting from a lot of readers, that they say they saw themselves in that book and they didn't like what they saw.
On the other hand, I would like to sort of I do sort of want to play devil's advocate a little bit and wonder, you know, can we objectively ask whether sort of the ultra flamey people are holding the gay rights movement back? So, you know, yes, we appreciate Stonewall. Thank you, drag queens and outrageous people, for getting this going. But now that it's going, is there a valid intellectual point that now the proper, most effective way to go is to sort of straight it up a little bit?
Well, see, you're asking that as if there's one agenda.
Right.
It's funny. I always hear that phrase, the gay agenda, as if all gay people want one thing.
Indeed.
No, well, we've had shows where some guy...
There's only one gay agenda, that's like getting laid. That's the only gay agenda that every gay man I know agrees with.
See,
other than that, there is no gay agenda.
No, that's not true. I've seen DJ Corey come in with one sheet of paper with the gay agenda written on top, and he wouldn't let me read what was on it.
It was right after the meetings.
Yeah, but it was right after the meetings.
But other than that, like I said, there isn't one. And so you ask, like, do they hold us back? But a lot of the guys who are in the activist community would say, hold us back from what? They're not interested in a place at the table. As far as they're concerned, they're going to turn the table over.
Right.
They're not in the slightest interested in being assimilated into mainstream America. That's not what they care about. And so you'd have to, you know, when you say, do they hold us back, you know, I guess you could say that some people like that do hold back other people perhaps from getting the kind of acceptance they would like to have. But at the same time, that's not what they care about.
I mean, this is a long-running debate in other parts of, I guess you could call it the American identity politics debate, other than just gay rights. Like, certainly African Americans in the U.S. face the same question.
Exactly.
Like, should they assimilate and become basically, you know, Cosby middle class Americans, or should African Americans, or do they forge their own identity, right? Do they try to be intentionally different because
there are a lot of similarities.
Different.
There are a lot of African Americans who really resent it when gay people use them as an example, because the first thing they always say is, hey, look, I didn't choose to be black, as if we choose to be gay. And anybody can look at me and see I'm black, but people don't look at you and know you're gay. Well, that's not always right either. There's
right.
A lot of people you can look at. And I, you know, I get some fire for this because I was talking to a professor once, and I was beginning a sentence by saying, there are a lot of gay guys you can look at, and you kind of can tell they're gay by the way they talk and move. And I started to move on to my point, and he interrupted me, and he said, well, no, that's not true. And he actually was arguing with me that just because a guy acts really effeminate doesn't mean that people assume he's gay. And I'm thinking, what planet is this guy from?
Well,
now, of course people think that. I mean, that's the whole point. That's the whole premise of sissyphobia. But anyway, to get back to the main point I was saying, a lot of black guys and I guess black women too, they resent it when, you know, gay men and women use them as an example of do you assimilate or do you forge your own community and only come to terms with the, you know, the white America when you need to. I mean, that's an ongoing thing. What's the best for the society as a whole? I happen to believe that assimilation is the best for everybody, because the more black people, white people know, the more they will care about the things that trouble them specifically. The more gay people, straight people know, the more they will care. There's all sorts of polls that tell you that if somebody knows a gay person, he's 80% more likely to be in favor of gay rights than if he doesn't know anybody who's gay. Because it's really easy not to want somebody you don't know to have full equal rights and representation.
Well, I think the way forward is clear then. Door-to-door campaigns of full frontal friendliness.
Of course. Or we could just do that when we recruit.
Actually, you touched upon something which, again, you mentioned in your book, too, like that when somebody acts in an effeminate way, like everyone assumes they're gay. I have, like, a couple, like, straight male friends who act somewhat effeminately, mm-hmm. and, like, it's kind of the running joke that, like, oh, they just don't know they're gay. Like, oh, they're really gay, but they they're just not admitting it to themselves yet.
Pardon the expression, everybody but that's a real tough nut.
And that's tough. Like it's
because
very.
Sometimes they are gay. And
I mean,
they
it's
just
very,
haven't gotten to a point where they can admit it yet, and everybody knows but them. Other times, I suppose there are effeminate behaving straight men, but I got to tell you, I haven't met too many of them.
Well, I mean, it's my point was going to be, it's kind of just as unfair to them to say, oh, you know, little Billy is, you know, gay as the day is long. He just doesn't know it yet, nor does his wife or three children. Like, it's just as unfair to paint him with the gay brush as it would be to say, oh, this extremely butchy leather, like, leather wear and gay man, he's really straight and he's just trying to hide it by acting gay. Do you know what I mean?
Is that a common idea to think that butchy leather or gay man is actually straight?
I mean, I'm opposing it with a silly idea, right?
Yeah. You know, like I said, I've known so many guys who were pretty effeminate, and like that's one reason why I depend mainly on anecdotal things, because who can know? And what book, what textbook can tell you this? You know, what college professor really can tell you this? Especially a college professor who will tell you that, you know, just because somebody behaves in a feminine way doesn't mean that anybody would presume they're gay, when of course most people will, whether they're straight or gay or what. But that's why I depend on personal stories, because that's all I can really go on. And unfortunately, I really wasn't able to really nail down anybody who's actually certifiably straight, for lack of a better phrase, and interview them, because a lot of the guys who initially claim they're straight later will admit, yeah, I guess I'm gay, or at least they'll claim they're bi.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking in terms of popular media figures, Andy Dick is one, right? Like this comedian who...
Boy, if there was ever a more aptly named comedian.
Yes, it's true. Every time
he's utterly unwatchable to me. I can't.
Well, regardless of our feelings about Dick's comedic talents, every time, for example, Andy Dick goes on the Howard Stern show, all Howard Stern will say is, "Come on, Andy, just admit it, you're gay."
and then he talks about all the strippers he's dating.
Yeah.
Right?
Again, I have no personal knowledge one way or the other, and don't care to have.
Just a follow-up comment on what you said. I mean, you know, in a world of infinite variation, of course you're going to find straight-acting men who are gay and gay-acting men who are straight. But I think, you know, everyone's personal experience is probably in line that, you know, if it quacks, it's probably a duck.
Yeah.
Right.
Or some sort of sophisticated duck imitating robot.
It's like I said, you get into really a swampy area whenever you're dealing with human sexuality, and it's really easy to get pulled under.
Well, anytime you talk about identity politics and generalizations, people essentially have the same, right, feed the same argument that we've been having.
And sort of a second point, which I think you cover in your book, too, is, you know, you said, you know, when you talk to these people and they admit, yeah, maybe I am a little bit gay, I mean, then you get into this whole area of people's true sexual orientation is anyway, which is usually pretty, you know, we all know about the Kinsey scale. We all know.
Right, one of the parts of the book that I, you know, tried to do the most justice to was the different theories about why people are gay to begin with. You know, the predominant theory and the one most accepted by most people is that it's in our biology. It's a combination of genetics and hormonal things that happen in your womb as you develop that basically set you up to be gay if certain social circumstances make that possible for you. I mean, think about it. If you're born under the Taliban, well, I don't think you're going to be gay. I mean, I don't think you're going to ever be able to express that particular orientation. That's something that you're going to keep basically buried, or you'll be stoned to death. So, you know, that's an example. To a lesser degree, if you're born in an extreme fundamentalist Christian family, you're going to experience something of the same pressures to keep your sexuality under wraps.
Until you go to college, and then it's partay.
Yeah, but isn't there a sort of a cliche of somebody raised in a repressive environment will break out and go so far to the other side?
In America.
Yeah.
Because America affords that ability for it to happen, but I don't think it happens in Western society. It happens probably, certainly, yes. Mm. But in repressive societies that are repressive from the top down, where the religion and the government are the same, that's not as likely to happen.
Well, I've lived in an Islamic country, although a relatively progressive one, and homosexuality was still there. Maybe I guess I compare the situation to probably what the U.S. was like in the 50s, where it was there, people knew about it, it was clearly not acceptable. It was clearly the subject of a lot of jokes, but, you know, it was there if you knew where to look.
Exactly, and that's where I talk about the situation where sometimes the effeminate guy throws on even more effeminate behavior, more flamboyant behavior. That way the quote-unquote straight-acting, straight-looking guy can come have sex with him and leave with his sense of masculinity intact.
And this brings up another – oh, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you, Corey. This brings up another issue that you talked about in the book. Is like, I think you I can't remember his name. There were so many. Like, you talked about, it was either a friend of yours or a friend of a friend of yours who kind of came out in the closet in his late teens, early 20s, and immediately went from this kind of shy but straight-acting man to, like, so gay he was on fire.
Oh, that's, like, well, that wasn't just somebody I personally have known dozens of people like that. That was something everybody either knows somebody like that or has been somebody like that.
And so, I mean, so what do you think the reason for this is? Is it just like a celebration of their new identity?
It depends. There's a difference that has to be drawn between effeminate behavior and flamboyant behavior. You know, flamboyant is the much more crazy cousin. That's the guy out in the bar, you know, screaming with the tight clothes and just, you know, going off like Emmett on Queer as Folk, if you ever watch that. That's something, that's supposed to be in Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah. This has been discussed many times.
In an alternate universe where this guy is green.
That doesn't actually exist.
Yeah. Half Pittsburgh, half Vancouver, I believe.
Really? But, or Toronto.
It's from Toronto, I'm sorry.
But,
it's all Canada. It's all the same to me.
But, yes, right, blame Canada. So there's the difference between effeminate and flamboyant. There are some people that live in a repressive type home, and when they finally do come out and they go out and they see that as what they see as the identified group behavior, they slip into those, you know, shoes or those pumps. And that's how they and that's how they choose to behave. And sometimes they do it for a while and then kind of grow out of it. Because it just helps them establish their identity. It's you know, some people slip into several different personalities throughout their life. I mean, I guess speaking of me, when I went in the Marine Corps, if you saw me out with my Marine buddies, I probably acted a lot differently then than when I was out of the bars. So, and it's not something that you really consciously do. It's just something that people do. I mean, I explain it this way. And none of this is meant to be any kind of a racial comment. It's more of an ethnic or cultural comment. If you ever notice a bunch of African-American men of all sorts of different walks of life, if they get together, sometimes they start talking street, you know, and they start getting loud and they start getting really big gestures and everything. And I've noticed exactly the same thing when Italian-Americans get together. Mm-hmm. They start getting real – the hands fly everywhere. And, you know, and it's like same thing when gay people get together. Suddenly it's like they get this thing. It's you identify suddenly with your group. You found your soulmates. You found your family. And you start, you know, kind of ramping up the mannerisms.
I've experienced a similar thing when my family of wasps get together. The air gets so cold you can freeze meat on us. but to talking
Boy,
about...
Just take it.
Talking about
so hard in this country.
gay unfriendly societies. One of the most fascinating aspects of this book is your discussion of being a Marine, actually, and going into the Marines consciously after you knew, after you'd come out to some people, right?
Yeah, not a lot of people go back in.
Yeah,
that's a tough choice. But it was one of those personal situations where I was 22. The economy was starting to go into the toilet during the. It was like the second year of the Reagan administration, before the beginning of what constituted a boom in the 80s, mm-hmm. which was nothing as you know compared to the boom we actually had. The real boom we actually had in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But people were getting laid off left and right. People were getting laid off from government jobs, and that had never happened. I was growing up just outside of D.C. And at that point, I didn't have any college, and I just was looking at just a succession of just menial, mindless jobs, and I just felt that I had to kind of reshuffle my deck. And so one day I was at the unemployment office, and I looked up at the Uncle Sam Wants You poster, and for the first time he was pointing at me.
Well,
and
see,
I thought, wow, I could do that.
If it's purely a financial decision, I would imagine people wanting to go to, for example, the Coast Guard instead of the Marines.
I originally thought about the Air Force.
Yeah.
Which is as close to the Coast Guard, I guess, as you can get of the four major services.
Wait, well, I call it the Coast Guard of the air.
Yeah.
which is the gayest of the four major services?
We'll get back to that.
Okay. All
and
right.
Because I can tell you from field experiments.
I'm sure you can.
And I went in to the recruiter, the Air Force recruiter, and he told me I did great on all the tests, that pretty much I could be anything I wanted to be in the Air Force, and he'd see me in 6 months. And I was like, what? He goes, well, you know, we're congressionally mandated to have only so much people in our force structure, so, you know, you're like five guys waiting to get in for everyone waiting to get out, so maybe 6 months before I can get you in. And I was all dejected, and as I was leaving, all of a sudden I hear, and I look, and there's the Marine recruiter in his office, and he's looking at me, he's going, And I'm like, no.
Are you
away.
Sure he wanted to recruit you or was there?
No, he wanted to recruit me. And he wanted to recruit me into the United States Marine Corps. And a half hour later, he convinced me I wanted to be a Marine. He was very good. But he didn't do anything but tell me what I really already knew, is that I was looking for a challenge. That's why I was there, and something new in my life, which is why I was in a recruiting office to begin with. And if I was going to do it, why not do it? Why not go all the freaking way? And I, you know, it was 7.5, 8 years of the best years I ever had. Of course, till I got kicked out.
So. Yeah.
Well, I mean, are you? I'd like to ask you about your experiences there, but first I have to ask: is there anything that you're sort of not allowed to talk about your hot gay experiences in the Marine Corps?
Other than name full names,
excellent.
So that I could get sued, I suppose not. I mean, I'm always toying around with putting together. Actually, I have a story. There's a book also available from Hayworth Press called "A Night in the Barracks." It's basically true stories of guys and some of the
book.
Hotter experiences that they've had, and the first story in there is by me. It's called Sex as a Weapon.
Interesting.
Ooh.
A Night in the Barracks.
Sex with a leper?
Sex is a Weapon.
Oh, okay. I think I have that book, actually. I'm not sure. I mean, I have similar books of that nature.
It's edited by a fellow by the name of Alex Buckman, and there's another hot guy on the cover of that.
Same hot guy? Is
no,
like Fabio?
No, it's a different hot guy. This guy's actually like a former Marine or something who's on the cover.
Okay. So I was going to say, when I see books like this, I often wonder whether they're complete fantasy, as, you know, you expect a lot of...
I can tell you mine was.
Well, just because it's fantasy doesn't mean it didn't actually happen.
Right.
Well, I was going to ask a little bit, a little bit about your experiences in the Marines, right? So you entered and you said you started to act more straight.
You know what? I hate to say act more straight because that makes it sound like I'm putting on an act.
Behave?
I think what I simply did was emphasize those parts of my behavior which were already fairly heterosexual appearing anyway. I've never really been anybody's, you know, queen anyway. That just wasn't part of my, you know, behavior anyway. And so I just probably just, without even realizing it, was, you know, subconsciously editing out certain phrases. What's up with you, Mary? Or, oh, get over it.
And so, no, like, for a long time, like 8, 9 years, nobody...
8 years, yeah.
8 years, nobody suspected.
Nobody suspected unless I told them.
Right.
Because, you know,
unless
you can
ejaculate
like,
on them. Right.
I mean, Gaydar is pretty good in the civilian world, but the trouble with Gaydar in the military world is that most successful gay guys who are in the military come equipped with stealth capability.
But, I mean, the military has poured billions of dollars into Gaydar. You'd think they could have defeated that by now.
But they don't. And it's amazing. I mean, people would be shocked at some of the guys who are gay in the military, especially in the Marine Corps. Some of the roughest, toughest, scariest, just rip your head off and tinkle down your neck kind of guys, you know? I said tinkle.
Well, yes.
We wouldn't normally say tinkle, of course.
You know, it just takes a little bit of the bloom off the macho rose when you say
really
tinkle.
Does.
So these guys, obviously, to get kind of back to the point of your book, like these guys, I would assume, like, were the guys they liked were also the very macho guys.
No, not always. You can't ever assume that just because somebody is muscular, he likes muscular guys, or if somebody's thin, he likes thin guys. Or somebody who is very masculine, that he prefers masculine men. You can never make that assumption because everybody finds something, something different. Everybody gets hot down there for a different reason.
Hey, can we ask how you got busted?
Excuse me?
Can we ask how you got busted?
Oh, busted. That sounds so bad. That makes it sound like, you know, they busted in the barracks door and caught me doing some boy.
No, I'm intrigued by the standards of proof they need before.
They don't need much.
Yeah.
It's really funny. I was stationed in the Philippines at the time in the Far East Network Subic Bay, and I had probably gotten to a point where I was just – I'd gotten out of living in the barracks with other Marines and having daily contact with other Marines because I was working for a Navy-run broadcast station that was overseen by the Air Force. So my sense of Marine Corps discipline and Marine Corps decorum was gradually eroding without me even realizing it. And because of that, I started letting down some of the guard that I was so used to keeping up without even thinking about it. And I started getting too close to some of the civilians that lived nearby. And people began to talk. And it doesn't take much. And then rumors started and people started investigating me. Now, they were never able to determine absolutely that I was guilty of anything but having a lot of good-looking male friends.
Until you wrote a book about homosexuality and feminine behavior.
But that was several years ago, yeah. Several years later. And, I mean, at one point they had 9 different agents tailing me. I don't mean all at once. I mean, you would have thought it was Aldridge Ames or something. But at one point, at various points, 9 different agents. I mean, staking out my barracks, following me around town, taking pictures of me. I mean, they have to give you the dossier that they compile on you when you get discharged, and it's a half inch thick, and I'm not exaggerating.
Well, did you know they were telling you at the time?
Or? Oh no, I had no clue. Wow. I had no clue I was being investigated until I got called in one day, and was told. Actually, it was a strange thing where somebody called my office and asked what time I got home, and I heard my coworker say he usually leaves here about 1, and then they hung up. And I determined later that what they did was they were searching my room, and I think tapping my phone.
Wow!
Wow!
It's quite a bizarre thing. Now, you could say, well, that was before "Don't Ask, Don't Tell." That was back when the policy was just "Don't."
Well, I've heard it's gotten even worse.
In some cases, it has. Yeah. So, and paradoxically, in a way, it was. If you think about it, it was predictable because once you establish "Don't Ask, Don't Tell," you're admitting they're gay people in the services. When I was in, they could always claim, oh, we ask them if they're gay when they come in, and if they say no, well, you know,
right.
Then if they say yes, then they don't get in. So there are no gay people in the services. They could claim that, as stupid as it sounds, you know, they sound like tobacco company executives claiming nicotine isn't addictive. But these days, with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you're acknowledging they're gay people that are in. But the military keeps forgetting the third part of that, don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue.
So is Don't Ask, Don't Tell a complete sham then? Is it?
You know what? I actually have another site that I have. Can I give a shameless plug?
Oh, absolutely. Plug away.
Please. It's called
endtheband.com.
End the band?
Endtheband.com.
End the band. And like end the band played on?
No. End. End. Oh. Like make it end. Oh, will it ever end?
Okay.
End the band.
See, no, not end the band, but
end
the band.
End the band.
Okay.
God, do I have to write these things down for you guys?
Well, we're slow. Sissyphobia. Well, it's catchy. Sissyphobia, I can spell that.
End the band.
Well, we thought you were being clever. You know, there's this great famous movie and the band plays.
No. Anyway, and on that site, I talk about this, and I have a lot of links for people who are in the military and might be gay and have places that they can go and, you know, various things. And a little logo I have of a camouflage triangle.
So is that your picture on the front page of this site?
Yes, it is.
I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, that's me from Subic Bay in 1988, I believe. Huh. Looking all butch in those camouflage utilities.
Oh, I think DJ Corey will enjoy these.
Well, what my co-host doesn't know is that I furtively attached a penile strain sensor to his hey, nice chest. And it's reading 11 right now, so I don't know.
I hate to be controlling, but we're running out of time, and there are two topics we absolutely have to get to.
Sure.
Before the end. The first is the project you're working on now.
Oh, yeah.
That's content to rest on your liberal sissophobia.
Right. The second book is called Reeling in the Years, Gay Men's Perspective on Age and Aging.
It's not a gay man's perspective on Steely Dan?
No, I know. Leave me alone. You have to remember, there are a lot of young people now who they had never heard of Steely Dan before the Grammy Awards and said, who the hell are these guys?
Yeah.
But, no, it's about all the different ways age affects gay people, both, like, you know, what's it like to be 75 and gay in America in 2001? What's it like to be 15? And living, you know, in Podunk, Iowa or something.
See, this is a topic near and dear to this show's heart because, you know, perhaps the core narrative of this show is DJ Corey's, you know, continuing struggle to come to grips with his sexuality as he ages.
It's true. You might as well be writing books, you know, about me. Both your first book and this upcoming book seem to...
Well, it's funny because if you think about it, there are three groups that constitute the unholy trinity in the gay community. One is femmes. One are old people, and what's the third? Fat people. I was thinking about writing a third book about fat people, about what it's like to be fat and gay or be out of shape, about the whole body image worship in the gay community. But I just don't think I can take time away from my novel, which has been on hold for 5 years now, to do any more nonfiction books after I finish.
See, I wonder what the logical extension of this idea is. Do you write about... You know, gay men with really bad skin, gay men missing a couple of fingers.
It's amazing how I'm covering a lot of it in this new book. There's a chapter I have called Forever Young, and it is the length that people will go to try to stay young and youthful looking. I mean, sometimes it's extraordinary, and sometimes, frequently, it's exceedingly sad that people believe they have to change what they look like in order to be palatable to this community.
Although that's certainly not unique to the gay community.
No, everything in the gay community is like outrageously ramped up compared to the straight community outside.
So what's the plastic surgery of choice for the gay community?
I think probably more people have nose jobs than anything else.
Intriguing. I would have expected facelifts, maybe, from what you were saying.
Nose jobs more often than not, but I think facelifts probably follow. And hair restoral, I think. Hair restoral is probably the second behind nose jobs. Because a lot of people don't believe they'll be desirable if they're bald.
See, the gay bald people, another book right there.
But a lot of guys find that sexy, and they shave their heads when they still have a full head of hair. So I think the thing is, if people are comfortable in their skin and they appear to be comfortable with who they are, they're 100 times more attractive than if they're pretending to be something they're not.
Is that true, DJ Corey?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, maybe in your, like, futuristic fantasy world, that's true. But along the lines of plastic surgery, I just had to say, you know, I bet the only thing that's keeping, like, penis lengthening surgery from being, like, the number one surgery in America is it's just not ready yet. I mean, that's going to be huge when that...
Part of expression.
It's not just that there are no legitimate candidates for development, right?
I mean, there's no kind of techniques on the horizon.
Yeah, yeah. Right? It's not like they've got something, but it just, you know, the penis ends up blowing up one out of every 20 chances.
Everything I've heard, there's just so many drawbacks about that it's like nothing that anybody would really want to. I mean, some people do the thing where they have fat injected into it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it gets lumpy.
Or you can cut tendons.
Yeah. You know what? I spend most of my life trying to keep sharp objects away from that area.
I hear you, brother.
So that's why when people have it pierced, I'm like, you're a better man than I am, Gunga Din.
You're working on the new book. Do you know when it's going to be out?
I'm supposed to have it finished late summer, early fall 2002, and it should be out about the same time of year 2003. Usually there's like a year lead time between the time you finish the book and the time it's out on the streets.
Wow. Okay.
So sissyphobia.com. Tell your listeners to remember that.
Cool. We only have a couple minutes left, but the one last thing I wanted to get to was your interview with G. Gordon Liddy.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And before I get into this, sorry, I should point out to people, G. Gordon Liddy was one of the Watergate conspirators who was... What?
Yeah, one of the actual burglars.
Yeah, one of the actual burglars who, I don't know if he was pardoned, but he got out of jail relatively early.
He got pardoned by Jimmy Carter in 1977.
And has established a career as a sort of conservative but relatively reasonable firebrand talk radio show host.
He can be extremely persuasive, extremely personable, very, very funny.
Yeah.
He's a right-wing wacko when it comes to things like guns and defense and things like that. I have occasionally heard him say, you know, AIDS is not an epidemic. And I've heard him say some unflattering things about gay people. Apparently he has some gay neighbors. And so I thought, well, he's pretty homophobic. So I thought what I would do when I was starting this book, I'm trying to come up with some baseline quotes that are real nasty about gay people, just so I can kind of start baseline of homophobia and work back from there into reasonableness. So one Sunday I was drunk off my butt, and I wrote him an email. And in this email I referred to his shaved head and his big brushy mustache and his stated love of ABBA. And I, you know...
Which, for our uninitiated listeners, are various tells about homosexuality.
Yeah, and I, basically questioned his masculinity.
Oh, God. He came over and beat you with a mop handle?
Well, I was just hoping to get back a real nasty comment that I could quote. Instead, I get a call from his producer asking me to come on the show, which I've told people just goes to show you never drink an email. And I went on the show, and it's just surreal. I walk in, and there's a Watergate burglar sitting there. I mean, this guy's like history to me. And I'm sitting there, and I kind of recounted what I just told you guys for his audience, and then I talked about the ABBA thing. And he goes, well, I also like Judy Garland. Is that significant? And he basically just went with it. And we ended up, they bumped their news block, I think, like four times. And what was supposed to be 20 minutes ended up being an hour and a half.
Wow.
And
that's awesome.
We got lots of calls. And I got a ton of email later when I got home that day because I dropped my email address. And and people can reach me, by the way, for the book, sissyphobia@AOL.com. sissyphobia@AOL.com. Or you can email me through the site. But we ended up having a great time, and they've re-aired that particular show, I think, eight times now.
Oh, that's great.
On various holidays and, you know, Best of Liddy shows and things, they aired it. Guess it went well.
I've totally been there. I mean, at one time I was drunk and I emailed President Clinton, and after that I couldn't sit down for a week. Let's just put it at that.
So we've got about a minute left. What did you guys talk about?
Oh, for the Liddy show.
Yeah.
Basically, I was trying to basically get an idea of what it was like when he was growing up, how guys who behaved in an effeminate way, how they were treated, and what his belief about, you know, why gay guys behaved in an effeminate way, and all his stories kept going back to when he was in prison, and the bizarre way people acted there. You know, all roads led back to jail, and to me, it wasn't so much that what he said was really useful for my book. The experience was useful. Extremely useful, and it was the emails I got from this extreme right-wing audience, very deeply closeted gay guys, who were like, right on, somebody needs to write a book about those sissies. And that's when I began to realize I probably had a really interesting book here.
Well,
ended up interviewing several of them for the book.
On that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to say goodnight. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you,
Tim,
for being on the show.
Thank you.
Great.
It was a delight hearing from you. This is WRCT Pittsburgh. Please, you're all obligated to buy the book Sissy Phobia at your local bookstore. Or
listening to the show indicates acceptance of an implicit contract to buy the book.
Or go to sissyphobia.com. Tim Bergling, thanks so much for calling us. Thanks for everyone for listening.
Yeah.
And tune in next week, Tuesday at 11.
You're listening to a production of WRCT Public Affairs. The opinions contained within are solely those of the participants. Questions and comments can be addressed to WRCT Pittsburgh, 5000 Forbes Avenue, Pittsburgh, PA, or call 621-0728.
This is T. Gordon Liddy. I urge you to tune in to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 on your FM dial. If you don't, I'll break both your legs.
Some of the music you hear on this program may be considered to be offensive by some listeners. As a listener, you have the right to turn off your radio. As a radio station, we try to present music that is different and, we feel, necessary. Our aim at WRCT is not to offend you, but to expose you to new, different, and otherwise unavailable music. If you have any comments, please write to us at 1 WRCT Plaza, 5000 Forbes Avenue, Pittsburgh, PA 15213, or contact us through email at wrct@wrct.org.